always wanted him.
The boldness of this, the slow, calm way he said it, made my sister pause and collect herself before she spoke again, as if she realized she couldn't combat his accusations with emotion alone.
Well, you're not sure, are you? If you'd got any actual evidence, you'd have arrested me. So this is a pathetic attempt to get me to confess to something I haven't done.
Now she leaned across the table towards him.
You made me tell my sister about our family. That was low. You're not getting anything else. I've told you that I've got nothing to do with Ben's disappearance, and that's all you need to know. The rest is private. Why don't you get out there and start looking for him before it's too late?
She got up and went into the garden, slamming the kitchen door behind her. Chang went after her. I was left sitting at the table with Clemo. He cleared his throat.
I'm sorry to land this on you like this. I hope you understand that we have to follow everything up.
I just stared at him, wondering why anybody would ever do a job like his, and believing for the first time that he would do anything it took to find Ben.
Jim. Addendum to D.I. James Clemo's report for Dr. Francesca Minnelli. Transcript recorded by Dr. Francesca Minnelli, D.I. James Clemo and Dr. Francesca Minnelli in attendance. Comments to indicate observations on D.I. Clemo's state of mind or behaviour, where his remarks alone do not convey this, are also included. So, if you're happy to, I'd like to talk to you about your interview with Ben's mother and his aunt. Fire away. His manner is hard for me to decipher today. He seems more willing than usual to talk, but he has a professional mask on too. He's controlling his emotions. What an extraordinary revelation. I find it amazing that Nikki Forbes could have kept that information from her sister for all those years. It wasn't just her, it was their aunt as well. How did Rachel Jenner react? Total shock, obviously. I don't know what happened just after we left, but I can't imagine it was pretty. Am I right in thinking that this was a real moment of triumph for you in the case? Fraser was pleased. Yes, especially because they'd ruled out Edward Fount, the role-play guy, that same morning. So you were right about him. Yep. When Woodley went to pull Fount in, this was while I was with Nikki Forbes, he found him waiting with a woman, another role-play member, and she gave Fount an alibi. They'd gone back to Fount's flat together after the afternoon in the woods, shagging, basically, if you'd excuse my language, and in spite of the fact that she was nearly twice his age. And neither of them had mentioned this before because... Oldest reason in the book. She was married. To the Grand Wizard, apparently. Oh, my. Yeah. Bit messy. I won't repeat what Fraser said when she found out. He almost smiled. So you were able to move on from that line of investigation? Absolutely. Fraser was happy with how things had gone, but she had concerns about how we should handle Nikki Forbes going forward, so she felt that the best course of action would be to re-interview her the following day, give her and Rachel Jenner time to cool off. Did Nikki Forbes have an alibi for the Sunday afternoon? She told us that she was at a food fair. Big event, lots of stalls, very busy. It was a research for the blog she writes. We sent out DCs to interview all the people she might have had contact with, but they were scattered far and wide, as you might imagine, so we knew we'd need a little time to put together a picture of her movements. Did you speak to her husband? Again, Fraser felt we should wait on that just a short while. Her strategy was to look into the alibi first and give the family space while we worked out whether Nikki Forbes could actually be good for it or not. Did you agree? Absolutely. You got to fit the pieces into a jigsaw in the right order. Gathering evidence is the single most important objective when you have a suspect. That, not being sued by a victim's family, you can't just apply continual pressure without evidence. Or you could alienate the family? Exactly. And they could talk to the press and so on. You can imagine it, and it wouldn't look good for us. The press had jumped all over the case by then, and they'd have been only too ready to have a go at us as well. And, on a practical level, we were nowhere near understanding how the mechanics of an abduction could have worked if Nikki Forbes had carried it out. She had a family in Salisbury, so her setup didn't look like the perfect profile for a child abduction. Unless she didn't want her sister to have Ben, then she'd killed him. That was one of my hypotheses. And abductors don't always kill on purpose. Sometimes things go wrong and it happens then, but we had to build a proper case before we could act further. I asked Chris Fellows, the forensic psychologist, to send me his thoughts on Nicky Forbes. But the profile that your forensic psychologist made for you, the one that fitted Fount so perfectly, hadn't been much use. I disagree. We were still considering the non-family abduction as a strong possibility, and that profile could have fitted any number of suspects for that scenario. See, the thing about profiles is that you shouldn't just attach them to one suspect. They're a resource that you have to use as part of your armory as a detective. Profiles never solve cases on their own, but they can make you think in different ways sometimes, or look at people in a new light. And it's always good to have another pair of eyes on the case, especially when everyone closely involved is getting tired. You can be in danger of losing perspective. What was Emma's view on Nicky Forbes? To be honest, I didn't see much of Emma that afternoon. I was too busy holed up with Fraser making a plan. Did you see her that night? She said she was knackered. She wanted to go back to her place to get a proper night's rest. I didn't blame her for that. I was feeling that way myself. Could have slept on my desk. But I get the sense you were fired up, too. I was, yes, we all were, without a doubt. Felt like things were starting to happen.
Rachel. The immediate aftermath was the first in a series of new body blows. Nicky swept everything up from the table, all her hard work, gathered it hastily and tried to push it into her bag. Her movements were rough and clumsy.
"Don't," I said. "Please, don't."
I felt as though she was falling apart right in front of my eyes. I wondered if that's what it had been like when she first went to Esther's to live in the cottage, right after it happened, when I was a baby, when her grief must have been unbearable. And I realized that in the future, I would wonder about everything. From now on, it would be impossible to unpick every detail of my history, every assumption that had led to me building a sense of my own identity, and of Ben's identity. My past had been crumpled up and thrown into the fire, and I would have to sort through the ashes, with only Nicky as my guide. Nicky, who had lied to me for a very long time. Nicky, who said she'd lied to protect me. Nicky, who I needed.
"I should leave," she said. "You're better off without me. You know, I would never, ever hurt Ben. Can I just say that? I would never hurt Ben."
Her distress pushed her voice to an acute pitch, and I went to comfort her.
"I know you wouldn't."
She let her bag slide down her shoulder and onto the table, and the papers spilled back out of it. Her head fell onto my shoulder, and her body shook. "Are you surprised at my reaction to her? At my willingness to accept what I'd heard and offer her comfort?" It wasn't the end of it. Of course it wasn't. If I think back to that day, I can remember the stages I went through. I suppose it was like the stages of grief, although this was different. This was the processing of what felt like a betrayal. This was the seeping away of trust. After the door had clicked shut behind an adrenaline-pumped Clemo and a Chang who couldn't meet my eye for the first time, that first interaction Nicky and I had was, of course, a reflex, an urge to keep Nicky by me, to deny that anything had changed. She'd been my rock, always, and I couldn't contemplate any other existence. It wasn't in my DNA, or I'd thought it wasn't. After that exchange, we separated, Nicky unpacking her bag robotically, calling on those massive reserves of strength to anchor her to my table, to keep her going as she delved deeper and deeper into whatever the web had to offer her. I went to my safe place, to Ben's room, and I immersed myself in him, as was my habit. It was the only place I felt secure. His bedroom had become my womb. This was my second stage. I sank onto the beanbag on the floor of his room, and I felt as if I was cast adrift in a small wooden boat, shrouded by a watery grey mist. And suspended within each of the millions of fine droplets that made up the mist was the news, the bombshell that I'd just heard. and in this stage, it simply surrounded me, existing but not yet understood. And within it, I felt baseless, disorientated, and lost. The third state was the inevitable churning of my mind, the processing of what I'd learned and of its implications. The moment the droplets of mist began to settle on my skin and permeate it. It was when the knowledge became part of me, and it was irreversible. I had to face up to it. It led swiftly to the fourth state. That was the erosion of my trust, where the droplets on my skin turned to acid and began to burn, producing a feeling that was intense and painful, a pins and needles of the mind and the body. And it was so creepy and unsettling that I couldn't remain still any longer. I got out of Ben's bed and looked out of the window, and I saw Nicky below in my garden with the dog, petting him, encouraging him to pee. They stood on the soggy, tatty lawn by the abandoned relic of Ben's football goal, the net broken from the frame in places, the grass in front of it worn from where he'd played. I backed away from the window, not so that the press wouldn't see me, but so that my sister wouldn't. And as dusk fell again, wrapping itself around the edges of the day, I ran back through events until I thought about how I had started the day. The photographer in my garden, Nikki's anger with him, her outburst on the street, her loyalty. And then I thought about the previous day, and how it had started with an internet search and with a laptop that belonged to Nicky that needed a password. And how that password was the name of my son. And each intake of breath felt sharp in my lungs, and my mind roved further, and I thought of Nicky's discontent with her daughters, and what Clemo said about her wanting a son. And then I thought of her words. It was as if he was Charlie, reborn. I began to cry hot, silent tears, and they had sharp edges, just like my breath did. And they ran down my cheeks and soaked into Ben's nanny, which I held tightly to my face. When I heard Nicky's footsteps on the stairs, I got into Ben's bed, covered myself up, turned away from the door and tried to breathe slowly so she would think I was asleep. When she put her head around the door of the room and asked if I wanted any food, I didn't answer her. When she reappeared some minutes later with a tray of supper, I still couldn't look at her. Couldn't speak to her.
"I just wanted to protect you," she said.
She shut the door quietly behind her, respecting my privacy, and all I could feel was a throbbing. It was the pulse of the time since Ben had been missing, and it felt as if it had begun to beat faster.
Jim. Email. From Christopher Fellows, cjfellows@gmail.com, to James Clemo, clemoj@asbol.uk, 25th of October 2012, at 21:37. Re Nicola Forbes. Jim, good to speak. Fascinating development. I'll send you a full report tomorrow, but as agreed, here is a précis. Psychological markers for predisposition to sociopathic behaviour in Nicola Forbes might include any of the following. Tendency to control, affective instability, which could include jealousy and identity diffusion, unnatural interest in Ben, you've already mentioned this as a possible, if father is to be believed. Other generalized signs might include obsessive compulsive spectrum behavior, OCSD, and or delusional beliefs, though these can be well hidden. She's certainly been quick to be on the scene, which could indicate that she enjoys the attention that the case is bringing the family. Just speculation, but maybe an unresolved desire from her early experience, which was handled so discreetly by the aunt. There's more. I'll follow up ASAP with a full report. It'll be with you end of tomorrow latest. Best, Chris. Dr. Christopher J. Fellows, Senior Lecturer in Psychology, University of Cambridge, Fellow of Jesus College. Email. From Corin Fraser, frasersc@asbol.uk. To Alan Hayward. Alan Hayward at haywardmorganlaw.co.uk. CC James Clemo, clemoj@asbol.uk. Giles Martin, marting@asbol.uk. Brian Doughty, doughtyb@aspol.uk. 25th of October 2012 at 2306. Blog Warfare. Alan, we're in need of your services, as the weird and wonderful World Wide Web is once again involving itself in our police work. Could you cast your keen legal eye over this blog, please? www.whereisbenedictfinch.wordpress.com. You'll see that it relates to the Benedict Finch case, Operation Huckleberry. I've got two primary concerns. Firstly, there could be contempt of court issues, should he ever get to trial. Secondly, there's stuff appearing on there that's making me nervous, because it shouldn't be in the public domain. We're concerned that somebody within the investigation, either family or within our investigation, could be authoring the blog or leaking information to it. What I want to know is, can we find out who the author of the blog is, the self-styled lazy donkey, and what do we need to do to get it shut down? Is that even possible? I'm copying this to D.S. Martin and Inspector Brian Doughty from Internal Affairs. Quick response appreciated, obviously. Cheers, Corin.
Day 6. Friday, the 26th of October, 2012. Cases involving child victims are not only burdensome from an investigative standpoint, but are also emotionally exhausting. Law enforcement agencies are commonly tasked with the simultaneous pursuit of multiple, time-sensitive avenues of investigation, often with inadequate resources, i.e. financial, logistical, manpower. Boudreau M.C., Lord W.D., Dutra R.L. Child abduction. Aged-based analyses of offender, victim, and offence characteristics in 550 cases of alleged child disappearance. J. Forensic Sci. 44-3-1999. Webpage. www.whereisbenedictfinch.wordpress.com. Where is Benedict Finch? For the curious. ... Nothing to watch? Posted at 0503 by Lazy Donkey on Friday the 26th of October 2012. This blog wants to recommend a television program to you. Go to www.itv.com/Jeremy Kyle. You could try episode 198. I can't trust you with our son. You spend all your time texting instead of watching him. Or you might enjoy this. Episode 237. Admit you're a bad mom and you can't look after your children. Just a thought. Up to you. Oh, and one more thing. Did you know Benedict Finch fractured his arm last year and his mother didn't get it treated? He must have been in a lot of pain. Guess she wasn't bothered. Or perhaps she was just busy doing something else. Rachel. First thing in the morning, facing each other across my kitchen table in our dressing gowns, our eye contact patchy, the air between us oscillating with tension, Nikki told me that she was going to leave.
I think we probably both need some time, she said.
It was a quiet statement and a very controlled one, but it was also damp with the undercurrent of what we'd been through the day before.
Just for a day or two. Then I'll come back. Will you be okay, do you think?
I had to clear my throat before replying in order to moderate my own tone and maintain the perfect neutrality of our exchange. The alternative was shouting or weeping or accusation hastily spat out. After spending the night imagining darkly, now the sheer reality and familiarity of my sister's presence and her own contempt at composure kept me in check.
Okay, I said. That's fine.
It's the girls, she said, turning away, slotting bread into the toaster.
Of course you should go.
And I did feel a twinge of guilt then, because Nikki's girls needed her too. Steam billowed up from the kettle and settled in a moist coating on the front of one of my kitchen cabinets. Skittle dragged his cast laboriously across the floor and flopped heavily onto my feet. Nikki burned her toast, and I watched her back as she took it to the sink and used a knife to scrape the black crumbs from it with sharp motions. They fell in a layer of coarse powder.
"Cook some more," I said.
"I wanted to leave some for you."
"It's okay. I'll have..."
I started to say.
"You need to eat, Rachel."
It was an outburst, her composure splintering abruptly, and she dropped her toast and the knife into the sink and leaned heavily on her palms on the edge of it, so that her shoulders became sharp points on either side of her bowed head. She looked up at the window, and the darkness outside meant that her reflection was razor-sharp in the glass, and our eyes met in that way. She was the first to lower her gaze.
"Sorry," she said. "I'm sorry. Can I show you something?"
It was an email that had come from America during the night. Via the Missing Kids website, Nikki had contacted another family whose child had been abducted, and they'd replied to her, a message of support.
"Read it," said Nikki. "They understand."
She handed me her laptop. Two pages were up, one her blog, the other her email. I couldn't help noticing that she'd updated her blog.
"Dear Custard and Ketchup friends and followers, this is a heartfelt request for you to please bear with me just for now. I'm sorry to say I need to take a short break from blogging for family reasons. I was hoping to keep you busy with some new tasty Halloween treats, but that hasn't been possible. If you're looking for Halloween ideas, my post from last year is available still, and you'll find lots of fun stuff to make and decorate there. Next to come, Christmas cheer. Watch this space. I'll be back as soon as I can. Nikki, kiss."
She saw me reading it.
"Simon posted that. He updates it for me sometimes," she said.
And then,
"I'm wondering whether we should do a web page for Ben. I could link it from the blog."
I didn't know what to say. I looked at my sister's blog quite frequently, usually with some awe, especially at its mythologizing and professionalizing of family life. It was like a glossy food magazine, an enviable social diary. It was not my world. I clicked on the email instead. Email from Ivy Cooper, ivycooper@brettslegacy.com, to Nicola Forbes, nikki_forbes@yahoo.com, the 25th of October, 2012, at 23:13. Re-Ben. Dear Nikki, Brett's legacy, do some good. This is a time of tremendous pain for you and your family. We are praying for Ben and for your family. Our son Brett was taken from us 7 years ago, and since then, we've been through things that we never thought we would have to experience. Before he was taken from us, one of Brett's favorite things to say was, "Mom, let's do some good." And we decided to make this a choice for our future, so that we could offer some help to other families who find themselves in the same situation. We made this decision 5 years ago, soon after Brett's body was discovered, and... I stopped reading. I looked at my sister.
"What happened to Brett?" I said.
"Have you read it all? Read to the end, you must. They actually understand what it's like, and it's such a relief, honestly. I can't tell you what a relief that is. I've been struggling so much to find anyone out there who knows what..."
"What happened to him?"
I had to know. I didn't like the email. I didn't want to be part of this club. A family of devastated families. I wasn't ready for that. Ben was going to come back to me. I wasn't going to be like them.
"It's not relevant."
"It's relevant to me."
"Brett died," Nikki said. "Unfortunately."
"How did he die?"
"Rachel,
how did he die?"
"He was murdered by his abductor. But that's not the point. And they would never have found out what happened to him if the family hadn't worked really hard to get the police to pursue the case." Ben's coming back.
I hope he is. God knows I do. You know I do.
She was twisting a tea towel tight between her hands.
But we have to accept the possibility that he might not be back soon. That some harm might have come to him. It's been 6 days.
I couldn't hear it. Not from Nicky, not from anybody. Not now. Not ever.
I'm going to see Ruth,
I said.
I'm sorry,
she said.
This wasn't how I wanted this morning to go.
Jim, when you work a case like this one, you long for a lead. When you get one, you're all over it. And that's how I felt about Nicola Forbes. I've been ready to chase her to the end of the line. What you don't expect is for something else just as strong to turn up, because then it's a bit like being in a shooting range, trying to decide what to aim at, what's a decoy and what's real, friend or enemy. Where should your sights land? You can't always tell straight away. But sometimes you're presented with a clear and immediate threat, and it's obvious that you must respond to that. That's what happened on day 6 of the case. The letter arrived, and it changed the game completely. It came in the Morning Post. Postmark BS7, addressed to Fraser directly at Kenneth Steele House. Fraser's secretary opened it. Her scream could be heard out in the corridor at the far end of the incident room, and she bolted out of her office. Fraser pulled us in straight away. The letter was in an evidence bag by then, and the secretary was already having her fingers inked next door so we could eliminate her prints. She was shaking and tearful, an extreme reaction for somebody who regularly got to file crime scene photographs. Jim, Fraser said once we closed the door behind us, get John Finch in. Emma was there too. She didn't look as though she'd slept. Under her makeup, her skin was dull and strained. To anybody else, she probably looked more or less her usual self, a tired version of herself, of course. But I could see a few extra small signs of disarray. Her hair wasn't tied up as neatly as usual, and her shirt didn't look fresh. You can do that if you want to know every inch of somebody better than you know yourself. I wanted to put my arm around her, ask her if she was coping, but I couldn't, of course, not there, not then. Emma's phone rang just as Fraser finished filling us in. She glanced at it. It's Rachel Jenner, boss, she said. Should I tell her? Nuh-uh, said Fraser. No word, nor yet.
Rachel. Chang agreed to come and give me a lift to the nursing home. She drove carefully and we didn't talk. Sitting beside her in the silence, I felt, for the first time since Ben had gone, a sort of awakening. An impulse from within, which told me to lift my head up from the sand, to stop burrowing into my memories of Ben and, instead, to look around me, to be more alert. I needed to consider people, to assess them, as a detective might, as Clemo might, and I needed to do it now. I'd placed my trust in my husband and my sister in the past, and both of them had proved themselves unreliable. I needed to consider my assumptions about life, too. I'd also placed my trust in the veneer of a civilized society, the lie that is sold to us daily, which is that life is fundamentally good and that violence only happens to those who warrant it. It tarnishes only the trophy that's already stained. That's the same logic as the age-old accusation that a raped woman somehow deserves it, and based on that, without questioning it, I'd trusted that if Ben ran ahead of me in the woods, then he would come to no harm, because I believed myself to be fundamentally good. And worse, the betrayal had been a double one, because Ben had also put his trust in me, in the way that children must. And so I'd failed him as well as myself, abjectly and possibly finally. I looked at Chang's hand on the wheel, her knuckles white as she gripped it firmly at 10 to 2, and I realized that, beyond my first impressions, I hadn't before thought about who she really was, or what she might be like. "Do you have a family?" I asked her as the car idled at a junction.
"I have a mum and a dad," she replied.
"I mean, children of your own." Though as I said it, I realized she was probably too young.
"No," she shook her head. "I won't have children for a while, if ever."
"Oh?" You know that already?
I do.
Can I ask why?
Because I'm not ready to be responsible for somebody else's life yet.
She said it so simply that it gave me a frisson of shock, because I realized that she already knew what I was only just working out. That we should look very carefully indeed before we leap, or believe, or trust. And that this younger woman had recognized that before I did only made me feel more foolish. I didn't know how to respond, so I fixated on what was around me. Outside, the sky was the kind of grey that looks perpetual and heavy, and the clothing of the people in the street was flattened against them by a strong wind. I retreated back into silence and the slow unfurling of the thoughts in my head, where I was starting to doubt everything I ever thought I'd known. There was one consolation at that moment when everything weighed unbearably heavy and when suspicion was beginning to edge into every corner of my mind. It was that I was on my way to visit Ruth. I desperately wanted to see her because she was one of my favorite people in the world. Ever since Ben was a baby, she'd been a reassuring presence in my life, offering me gentle, unconditional support, and our friendship had grown alongside him. Life hadn't been easy for Ruth. To those who didn't know her, she would appear dignified, proud, and fragile. Always chic in a uniform of dark clothes, with a scarf neatly tied at her neck, a silky flash of color. As a young woman, she'd had the talent to be a concert violinist, but she'd also felt things so deeply that they could wound her. Her violin playing had captivated John's father.
"I fell in love with her the first time I saw her play,"
Nicholas Finch would proudly tell everyone in his Brummy accent. In fact, most people who'd heard her play were entranced. She'd trained and performed on the instrument for years, but ultimately found public performance an intolerable pressure, and as a result, when she was in her 20s, shortly after marrying John's father, she'd sunk deeply into the first of many bouts of deep depression that she suffered throughout her life. I first met Ruth in early 2003, a good year for her. She and Nicholas were enjoying his retirement. After a long career as a GP, which had kept him working all hours, finally having him around had helped Ruth remain stable. They were planning to buy a small apartment in the Alps, and they'd taken a successful trip the previous year to Vienna to see the buildings and neighborhoods that Ruth's parents grew up in. Lotte and Walter Stern had been musicians too, both successful and well-respected performers before the war, but they'd become refugees, driven from Vienna after Kristallnacht, when Lotte Stern was heavily pregnant with her daughter. In the summer of 2003, John and I made our first visit together to his parents' home in Birmingham. I found Ruth and Nicholas charming and welcoming. Their contrasting personalities intrigued me. Nicholas was a big, warm-hearted man with a kindly, relaxed manner, which had won him many friends amongst his patients during his years as a GP. His bonhomie was the opposite of Ruth's nervous disposition, but she welcomed me cautiously. Ruth's mother and father both died in 2004, and she took it hard. As a tribute to them, she preserved many of their traditions long after their deaths. Lotte Stern had kept a special white tablecloth just for making the delicate strudel pastry that she took much pride in. Ruth kept the tablecloth, and more than once made what we called Lotte Strudel with Ben, asking him to stir the filling while she showed him the methods she used to stretch and roll the wafer-thin pastry. In fact, it was the tiny Benedict Finch, only 6 pounds 13 ounces when he was born in July 2004, who brought Ruth back to us after her parents' death. She adored him instantly. She opened her arms to him and never wanted to let him go. And to all of our surprise, she included me in that embrace. Right after Ben's birth, she came to stay and she helped me through the difficult first weeks and months. And then she never stopped helping. She became a companion to me, a friend, and a wonderful grandmother to Ben. John told me a story about Ruth once. It was a rare confidence about his childhood that he told me just after I'd met her. I think he wanted to explain her to me. It was a story that showed her darkness and her light. When John was about 9 years old, he'd gone to see Ruth after school. It was during one of her periods of depression, and he was ushered quietly into her darkened bedroom to show her a prize that he'd won that day. Ruth examined his certificate and then propped it up on her bedside table. She patted the bed beside her. It was a rare invitation, and John sat down carefully, desperate not to break the moment, daring to do nothing more than glance around the room, which the drawn curtains had given a chiaroscuro quality, so it felt to him as if he and his mother were drawn characters in a children's book.
"Where I am weak," she said to him that afternoon, "you can be strong, like your father."
She held his hand tenderly, examining with the tips of her fingers each of his. He remembered that sensation. Then she spoke to him of music. John explained to me that when Ruth was drained of life, she seemed always to have music left in her. And it was this that was her gift to him, even when she lacked the energy to get him up, make his packed lunch, or take him to school in the morning. After sitting with his mother until she was too tired to talk any more, John left her room, with his little heart beating, relieved to escape her intensity, yet longing for more of it. When we arrived at the nursing home, Chang said she'd wait in the car. Ruth was in her room. It was a generous size, one of the nicer rooms upstairs, with large windows overlooking a garden and some mature trees below. It was 1,000 times nicer than some of the grey and murky spaces we'd looked around before placing Ruth here. Those homes were like holding pens, where residents waited for death with little more status than corpses. Loneliness, confusion, pain, and the smell of urine and boiled food seemed to be their only companions as the light faded on their lives. Those places had made me shudder and sometimes weep. Carpe diem was the lesson to be learned. It's what I would have been trying to teach Ben when I let him run ahead in the woods. Seize the day. Be brave. Be independent. Be thoughtful. Don't be scared to make mistakes. Keep learning. All of those things, all the time. And somebody had taken him. More fool me. Ruth's chair was turned to face the window. Her hand rested on its arm, her arthritic knuckles gnarled and inflamed, her fingers resting at unnatural angles. Macular degeneration was starting to steal her vision, and she had to keep her head at a sideways angle to see me properly. Somebody had done her makeup. There was rouge on her waxy skin, a smudge of the bright lipstick she'd always favoured. Classical music was playing softly, and I was relieved to see that it was a CD, as John had requested, and there was no sign of her radio, so there was no chance of her hearing about Ben on the news.
"Rachel," she said. "Darling."
She reached for my hands with her own and cupped them stiffly, a favourite gesture of hers.
"Where's Ben?" she said. "I missed you on Wednesday. People think I know nothing any more, but I do know when it's Wednesday."
She was putting a brave face on it, attempting to maintain her dignity, but I knew from her carers that her agitation had been more extreme than she was letting on. She was also more lucid than I'd expected, and I didn't know whether to be grateful for that or not. "He wanted to try chess club," I said. "I was planning to bring him over here after it finished, but he was feeling poorly when I collected him. I'm sorry, I should have phoned."
"You should have," she said.
Manners mattered to Ruth.
"I thought it was half term, but I'd forgotten. I'm a little forgetful nowadays, you know,"
she told me, as if this were news, as if I hadn't been minutely tracking the destructive progress of her dementia since her original diagnosis.
But Sister told me she was sure it was next week.
I'd forgotten that half-term was about to start. Of course I had.
What was wrong?
Ruth asked. He had a sore throat, a bit of a temperature. I think it was a virus.
Should he be back at school? Is he wrapped up warm?
Yes, I said. And the lie felt as though it might wind its way around my throat and tighten.
Is he working hard?
She said. Her eyes were milky, and the impotence of her condition wandered around their depths.
At the hospital.
She was confusing Ben and John. It happened often, and I went with it. Not too hard. He's doing well.
He must practice when he's better, because when he is big enough and good enough, he must have the testore.
The testore was Ruth's violin, a beautiful instrument made in 18th-century Milan, her most valued and valuable possession. He's not showing any signs of growing out of his half-size yet, I said.
No, but he will. They do, you know.
A half-smile played on her lips, a memory, and then died away again.
What's he playing?
Oscar Reading. Concerto in B minor.
The whole thing?
Just the third movement for now.
He must be careful with his bow control, in this passage in particular.
Ruth began to hum the Reading Concerto, her hand beating time. She had an extraordinary memory for music. Each note she'd ever played or taught seemed to have found a place to lodge in her head, all its resonance still alive to her. She'd started Ben on the violin when he was six, insisted on paying for his lessons. He was showing promise, some of the musicality that had travelled from Vienna through her family, and that thrilled Ruth. She stopped abruptly.
"Have you got that?"
she asked, as if I was her pupil myself. "Yes. I'll remind him." She pulled herself forwards. Her dress shifted over her skeletal knees, catching on the surgical stockings that she wore in her calves. I noticed a small stain on her pretty yellow scarf. On a table, just within her reach, a shiny golden sweet sat in the middle of a crocheted doily. Her hands scrabbled uselessly to grasp it, but I knew better than to offer to help, because that would have upset her. Finally, her fingers got a purchase on it.
"For Ben," she said. "I saved it."
On the rare occasions that Ruth took part in the communal activities in the home, she was ruthless about acquiring the sweets that were sometimes offered as prizes. She hoarded them for Ben. "Thank you," I said. She went through the same rigmarole to reach something else, a book. She passed it to me.
"Look at this. I got it from the library. Does it remind you of anything?"
A smile passed across her lips, a rare sight nowadays, usually only bestowed on Ben. I took the book, ran my hand over its shiny cover, and felt the dog-eared edges. It was a monograph, and its subject was the artist Odilon Redon. "The museum," I said, "when we took Ben to see the dinosaurs and ended up looking at the paintings."
"Yes,"
she said.
"I've marked the page. Can you see?"
I opened the book where she'd inserted a bookmark. It was a garish yellow strip of leather with a design of the Clifton Suspension Bridge embossed in it in gold. Ruth didn't have many ugly possessions, but this was one of them, and she kept it because Ben had bought it for her on a school trip.
"We looked at the William Scott painting first. You remember?"
said Ruth. I did. It was a huge canvas, wall-sized, with an ink-black background and four large, formless, abstract shapes floating within it, in white, darker black, and a complex shade of blue that brought to mind a sunlit Cornish coastline.
"What is it?"
Ben had asked me, his hand nestled in mine.
"It's whatever you want it to be," I'd said.
"I like it,"
he replied.
"It's random."
Random was a new word that Ben had learned at school, and he used it whenever he could. In the next gallery, Ben had been drawn to a small canvas by Odilon Redon, and a copy of this was revealed when I opened the book. In the museum, Ben had stood in front of it, just inches from it, while Ruth and I stood behind him.
"What is this one?"
he asked us. In the center of the painting was a white figure, mounted on a rearing white horse and holding aloft a long stick with a green flag at the top of it, which looked to be fluttering in a hot breeze. Behind the figure were two boats, barely emerging from the thickly painted background, with its suggestions of land, sea, clouds and sky in dusty shades of brown and blue.
"It's a bit messy," said Ben.
"The artist has done that on purpose," Ruth told him. "He wants to suggest a dream to you, a world where stories take place and where you can use your imagination."
"What is the story?"
"Like your mummy said about the other painting, the story is anything you want it to be. It's everything or nothing."
"I would like to have a green flag," said Ben.
"Then you could be an adventurer too, like the person in this painting. Would you like a white horse?"
Ben nodded.
"And what about a boat?"
Ruth asked him.
"No, thank you,"
he said, and I knew he would say that, because Ben had a fear of the sea.
"Do you know what I see in this painting?"
Ruth asked him. He looked up at her.
"I see a brave person riding a magnificent horse, and I wonder where that person is going and where they've been,"
she told him.
"And I also see music."
"Where is the music?"
he asked.
"It's in there. It's in the paint, and the sea, and the sky, and in the story of the person and their horse and the ships,"
said Ruth.
"All those things give me the idea of music, and then I can hear it in my head."
"And for me too,"
he said. He smiled at her. His face lit up.
"It's lots of fast notes, like an adventure."
"And slow ones too," said Ruth. "You see here, that thick bit of paint, where you can see how the painter smeared it on with his brush. That's a slow note for me."
Ben considered that.
"Can you hear it, Mummy?"
"Definitely," I told him. And in that moment, just the sound of his voice, the innocence ringing in it, the eagerness to listen, was music enough. On that day, my son was 7 years old, and I suspected already that he might not be the kind of child who could win a running race or triumph on a rugby pitch. So to see him respond in this way to the paintings was a joy. It gave me so much hope for his future, that sensitivity he had, the way that he might be able to respond so positively to beauty and to ideas. I felt it would enable him to create reserves that he could draw on when he needed to. And I knew I could guide him through that, or at least set him off on his way. What I hadn't realized on that day, as Ruth and I took him downstairs to find tea and cake, was that he might need to draw on his reserves so soon, before he would be ready. Or that he might never get a chance to build them up before they were shattered forever.
"Do you want to borrow the book?"
Ruth asked. I was lost on the page and the image, and her voice pulled me back to now.
Ben might like to see it.
What to answer? How to disguise my emotions? I managed only to say, "He would. Thank you."
Bring him to see me next week. Promise you will.
I was struggling to hold myself together. I went to stand at the window, keeping my face turned away from her, looking out at the beds of pruned roses in the garden below, at the sweeping, gracious branches of a mature cedar tree. But Ruth was no fool, dementia notwithstanding.
"What is it, dear?"
she said.
"I'm fine."
"I don't like to see you like this, my darling. Come, sit with me. Talk to me."
I wanted to. I so wanted to. But the thing is that if I'd told her, it would have destroyed her. So I didn't. "I've got to go now," I said. "I'll see you next week." I put my face to hers, said goodbye, kissed her. She clasped my head to hers, and for a moment the sides of our faces rested together. Her skin felt as smooth as gossamer, her cheek bony and delicate, barely there.
"Bye-bye, darling," she said. "Be strong. Remember, you are a mother. You must be strong."
Jim. I got one of the DCs to pick up John Finch and bring him in. He was with us within the hour. He looked thinner than he had at the beginning of the week. I put the letter down in front of him. "Don't take it out of the bag." He picked the bag up, fingernails bitten to the quick, shaking hands. He read out loud, "John Finch will now understand how it feels to lose a child. It serves him right. He has been arrogant, and now he will be humbled. By medicine, life may be prolonged, yet death will seize the doctor too." I watched him closely. He looked as if I'd swung a cudgel at his head and made contact. "Who sent this? What is this?" "It arrived this morning. We don't know who sent it. We're hoping you can help us find out." The shaking in his hand spread to his wrists. "Is this my fault? Have I done this? Let's not talk about fault. That's not going to get us anywhere at this point. Do you have any idea who might have sent it? We think it implies that the sender has had contact with you in a professional capacity. I know I've asked you before, but I really need you to think about this again now. Do you know of anybody who might have a grudge against you? A former patient?" John Finch looked like the most beaten person in the world. He looked like a man watching all his worst nightmares come true. His voice was tight with the effort it was costing him to control it. If I'm honest, I found the interview unexpectedly hard, and I think that's because I recognized myself in him. I knew that if I was him, I would be broken too, and somehow, although it shouldn't have, that got under my skin. I don't know if it was my fatigue, or the way he tried so hard to hold on to his dignity, or perhaps both, but there it was, a small feeling of solidarity with him that I shouldn't have allowed myself. "My patients are children, Detective. They don't tend to bear grudges. In fact, their view of the world is often beautifully simple, beautifully fair." He ran the fingertips of one hand around his eye socket. "But they have families, and sometimes, rarely, you lose a child during surgery and the families can't accept it. They blame you, even when there's nothing you could have done, even when the surgery was your only option because without it the child would have died. Can you think of any families who might have cared more than others? Cared enough to take my son in revenge, an eye for an eye?" "Yes." He shook his head. "Like I said before, there were one or two who tried to sue the hospital, but even that isn't very unusual. It's a risk we take in our profession." He passed a hand across his forehead, squeezed his temples. "I can't imagine them doing anything this extreme. I really can't. But I suppose there is one family that sticks in my mind as being more persistent than the others. I can give you the name of the child. The father's details will be on the records at the hospital. I pushed a piece of paper and pen across the desk towards him. Write down the name for me, I said, the one that springs to mind, and write down the person to contact at the hospital. He wrote. He passed the paper to me. Does Rachel know? He said.
Rachel. This time, I made no attempt at conversation as Chang drove me home. I stared out of the window and thought about Ruth and Ben, and how much they loved each other's company. I was transfixed by the sight of schoolchildren walking home with parents, or in messy groups without adults, shouting, laughing, jostling each other, dropping bits of rubbish which the wind picked up and blew around them. It was the start of half-term this afternoon, as Ruth had said, and they were in a celebratory mood.
Can we go to Ben's school?
We can.
Why?
Chang said.
I want to get his stuff. It's half-term.
She only hesitated momentarily.
Of course, she said.
She pulled into the forecourt of a petrol station to turn around, and we got stuck behind another car. It was impossible not to see the headlines, murky as they were behind the thick plastic of the forecourt newsstand. The front pages of two newspapers showed a photograph of me at the press conference, beside one of my sister in her nightie, berating the journalists outside my house. This is what I read before Chang pulled away. Finch Furies. Intimidating. Benedict's auntie lets rip. Sisters, who aren't afraid to look savage. Fears growing. 5 days missing and counting. And on another paper, underneath a photograph of my boy, Mystery of Ben's Clothing. New timeline of Ben's disappearance inside. Chang still said nothing. I wasn't sure if she'd seen them or not. I pulled up the hood of my coat and sank down into my seat. I was afraid of somebody recognizing me, and I was afraid of what they might say if they did. Ben's school was almost deserted as we arrived. We had to maneuver around some orange traffic cones that had been placed as a loose barricade across the entrance to the teacher's car park. Only a few cars remained there. Most of the spaces were empty. Chang parked in a spot where we had a view of the playground, a small tarmacked space with football posts painted on one wall and colourful murals on the others. It was a modest little school, with the old Victorian schoolhouse at its heart, and various unprepossessing modern additions tacked onto it over the years. Right up until the moment when we parked, I thought it was a good idea to visit the school. But as Chang undid her seatbelt and pulled the keys from the ignition, I found myself paralyzed by the fact of actually being there. It was the sight of the playground. It reminded me that this was Ben's world, his other world, and that the last time I was here was to pick him up the previous Friday afternoon. As Chang turned to me, wondering why I wasn't moving, images flooded my brain. The playground on Friday. It had been heaving as usual, crowds of parents waiting for children who were disgorged from the building in various states. Some looked as if they'd been catapulted out with the sole purpose of expending excess energy, chasing each other around between huddles of mothers. Others looked beaten down by the week, bags weighing heavily on their shoulders. Some were sporting stickers proudly on their sweatshirts. One or two burst into tears at the sight of their parent after a long day of pent-up frustration. I saw all this in vivid little bursts. Pushchairs, mothers laden like pack horses, snacks being distributed, tales of injustice or triumph. Children sent back into the building to get forgotten things. A teacher with a cup of tea in hand. The headmaster wearing a novelty tie on a rare outing from his office. A few parents flocking around him. Cut-out figures strung like bunting in the windows of the classroom behind them.
Are you having second thoughts?
Asked Chang.
No,
I said.
I want to do this.
I made myself focus, take a deep breath,